Imagine stepping into a senior leadership role and just doing everything perfectly, like literally hitting every mark.
Right, which is the dream, obviously.
Exactly. You build this incredibly healthy, vibrant team culture. Mm. You implement these operational systems that run like absolute clockwork.
Yeah.
You deliver undeniable, measurable success that transforms the entire organization.
Mm-hmm.
And your reward for this flawless performance.
Oh, man.
You get fired.
It's just, it shatters the fundamental narrative you're taught about career progression. You know, you grow up believing that meritocracy is this unbreakable law of physics, that hard work and undeniable impact just automatically guarantee permanence or, you know, a corner office.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today, you are getting a look at the raw, unfiltered reality of management. We are stripping away all those glamorous illusions of what it actually means to be a boss.
Yeah, and the source material we're unpacking today is so fascinating. It's a deeply reflective set of notes and Q&As from a highly experienced organizational leader.
Specifically, an assistant head teacher for teaching and learning in Ascend School. And just really quick, for anyone outside the education sector, SEN stands for Special Educational Needs and Disabilities.
Which is such a high-stakes environment. But the truths uncovered in an emotionally demanding setting like a SEN school, they translate directly to almost any organizational structure.
Clearly.
The pressure cooker of that environment just makes the cracks in bad leadership more visible, you know? And the necessity of good leadership becomes way more urgent.
Exactly. So whether you are a seasoned executive, a mid-level manager prepping for a big promotion, a teacher, or just someone who is insanely curious about why your organization functions or dysfunctions the way it does, this deep dive is going to completely reframe things for you.
It really changes how you view success, trust, and the actual impact you leave behind.
We are going to explore that central paradox, right?
Yeah.
Doing everything right, creating a lasting legacy, and still losing your job. But to truly understand the weight of that paradox, I mean, you have to look at the immediate shock to the system when you first step into a senior role.
Right, because the source makes a really stark observation right out of the gate. Leadership is inherently lonelier than being on the ground floor. You transition from being one of the team, where you share the day-to-day burdens, the collective complaints, the inside jokes, to holding a level of responsibility that simply cannot be shared.
You become the container for the organization's stress.
Exactly. You hold all of it.
It makes me think of like moving from being a star player on the field to being the coach on the sidelines.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Right. When you're a player and the game is going poorly, you can just rely on your own footwork. You can kick the ball yourself and score the goal.
Yeah, you have direct control.
But the second you step into leadership, you are confined to the sidelines. You can't just run onto the pitch and play the game for your team no matter how desperately you want to.
Which is so frustrating for high performers.
Right. You have to build the overarching system that allows others to succeed. But I have to ask, is that desire to be a hero leader who swoops in and fixes everything actually destructive to the team?
Oh, absolutely. Relying on individual heroics is precisely why organizational structures fail over the long term.
Wow.
Think about it. If a company or a hospital or a school is entirely dependent on the superhuman efforts of one incredibly charismatic leader to keep the wheels turning, that organization is fundamentally fragile.
Because what happens when they leave?
Exactly. What happens when that charismatic leader takes a two-week vacation or gets sick or takes a job elsewhere? The entire operation collapses because there was no underlying architecture.
The author distills this into a brilliant rule. They say, clarity beats charisma.
I love that line.
Right. A clear, consistently communicated vision matters far more than simply being the most well-liked person in the room.
Charisma might convince people to follow you into a meeting, but it does not sustain a difficult, grueling process over a six-month quarter.
Systems matter infinitely more than good intentions. Mm.
And building a system requires a leader to look at a blazing fire and recognize that it isn't theirs to put out personally.
Which is so hard to do.
It's incredibly hard.
Mm.
But sustainable leadership means developing the capacity of the people around you. You establish the structure, the accountability, and the follow-through, and then you trust the framework.
Because good practice completely dissolves the moment accountability vanishes.
Exactly.
But, you know, pushing a team toward a new system inevitably means altering the status quo. And systems, at the end of the day, rely on human beings to execute them.
They do.
And you cannot manage human beings through a massive organizational shift using only pure, cold logic. The source notes that change management is fundamentally emotional.
Yeah, when people push back against a new initiative, they're rarely arguing with the math on a spreadsheet.
Right, they're not mad about the data.
No, they're reacting to perceived threats. The human brain interprets sudden organizational change as a risk to stability.
So where does that resistance actually come from?
The author says it usually stems from three distinct emotional centers. It's either a fear of sudden incompetence, a threat to their professional identity, or panic about an unmanageable workload.
So when a leader rolls out, like a new software system or a new reporting protocol, the employee isn't just seeing a new tool.
No, they are wondering if their hard-earned expertise is suddenly obsolete.
Wow. And you see organizations attempt to manage that emotional toll in the most superficial ways possible.
Oh, all the time.
The corporate world is so infamous for this. A team will be completely drowning in new initiatives, working 12-hour days, and management will roll in with, what, a Friday pizza party?
Right, or a mandatory hour-long mindfulness seminar to, quote-unquote, cure the burnout.
Wait, so a pizza party on a Friday or a mandatory mindfulness seminar doesn't actually cure burnout? Who would have thought?
I know, shocking, right? The source is fiercely critical of that exact dynamic.
Right.
True staff well-being has absolutely nothing to do with yoga sessions or branded company water bottles.
Thank goodness someone said it.
Well-being is a working condition. It is defined by manageable workload expectations, violently clear priorities, and leadership that actively protects the team from initiative overload.
Piling 50 new mandates onto a team while simultaneously telling them to take time for themselves over the weekend is just a profound failure of leadership.
It's insulting, honestly.
It is. True well-being is about boundaries. A leader respects their team by ruthlessly cutting away the unnecessary noise so the staff can focus on the core mission.
And in the context of a SEND setting, the emotional labor of supporting students with profound behavioral and developmental needs is already exceptionally high.
Which brings us to a really serious point in the source material.
Yeah, the author states that well-being in this environment is not a nice-to-have HR perk. It is a literal safeguarding issue.
And for anyone outside the UK education system, safeguarding is not corporate jargon for safety. It refers to the strict legal protocols required to protect vulnerable children from harm.
Right. When staff are chronically burnt out, their situational awareness drops, their patience thins, and they physically and emotionally cannot deliver the high-quality care those students desperately need.
The students ultimately pay the price for the leadership's failure to manage workloads.
Exactly. Protecting staff well-being is an operational imperative. And the primary mechanism a leader uses to bridge the gap between building robust systems and protecting that staff well-being is communication.
Because poor communication rots a workplace culture faster than a string of poor strategic decisions ever will.
Oh, without a doubt. When communication is inconsistent or opaque, it breeds massive uncertainty.
And that uncertainty instantly converts into collective anxiety. People start filling in the blanks with worst-case scenarios, and rumors just take over the whole building.
But effective communication actively builds psychological safety. When a leader says what they mean, follows through on their promises, and listens to feedback without getting defensive, they dramatically lower the emotional temperature of the building.
People can actually focus on their jobs because they aren't wasting cognitive energy trying to guess where they stand or, you know, what hidden agenda is at play.
Exactly.
So if proper communication and genuine well-being form the foundation of psychological safety, how does a leader take these high-level concepts and actually apply them to the physical reality of hallways, classrooms, or office floors?
Well, it really all boils down to trust and behavior. Trust is the absolute currency of any functional organization.
And you build it through honesty and integrity, demonstrated consistently over time.
Right.
Not just selectively when it's convenient.
And the source makes a really beautiful distinction here regarding how trust operates across different demographics within the same building.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, students, particularly those with complex needs, trust leaders who are entirely predictable and genuine. But the adults, the staff, they trust leaders who are transparent and principled.
Predictable and genuine for the children. Transparent and principled for the adults. The through line there is obviously consistency. You cannot implement any kind of whole organization behavior management policy without that foundational trust.
And the author stresses that behavior management only works when it is highly relational and completely understood by everyone in the building.
Which introduces this concept of relentless consistency.
Yes. In a high needs environment, you need a shared language of behavior.
Like what? What does that look like?
So if a student is escalating in the hallway, the response they get from a first-year teacher needs to be structurally identical to the response they would get from the head teacher.
Right, because clear expectations and highly predictable routines create a secure environment.
Exactly. Predictability reduces anxiety, which in turn reduces behavioral outbursts.
But that consistency cannot be rigid or punitive, right? The source emphasizes that behavior management must be trauma-informed.
Yeah, it is not about demanding blind compliance to a list of rules. It's about understanding that behavior is a form of communication.
So when you understand the underlying distress or the trigger behind a specific action, you can actually prevent the escalation.
Instead of just applying a harsh exclusionary punishment after the fact.
And leaders must coach their staff through these moments, not assign blame.
Right. If a teacher is struggling to manage a specific dynamic, a strong leader provides modeling, strategic support, and reflective practice. They don't just point to a handbook and tell the teacher to figure it out.
There's a specific phrase the source uses here that completely shifted my perspective. The author states that interventions must be data-informed, not data-driven.
That is such a crucial distinction.
At first glance, I'll be honest, that sounded like pure semantics to me. But how does looking at behavioral patterns to guide intervention differ fundamentally from just reacting to a cold spreadsheet of rule infractions?
Well, being strictly data-driven isolates the numbers from the human context. It leads to rigid, punitive responses that don't actually solve the underlying issue.
Like seeing a kid had 5 rule infractions this week and blindly suspending them because the quote-unquote data dictates it.
Exactly. But being data-informed means looking at that exact same spreadsheet, analyzing the patterns, and realizing that, hey, all 5 infractions happened right before lunchtime.
Or immediately following a specific transition period.
Right. You are looking for the catalyst. Being data-informed humanizes the numbers. The data guides your curiosity.
Oh, wow.
Once you spot that pattern, the difficulty with transitions, for example, you can offer targeted coaching, alter the student schedule, or implement structural support.
You solve the root cause rather than just perpetually punishing the symptom.
Exactly. It completely changes the approach from punitive to supportive.
So let's pull all these threads together and apply them to the actual trajectory of the author.
Let's do it.
Imagine you are this leader. You have navigated the lonely transition from peer to boss. You accepted that clarity beats charisma, and you built a robust system that doesn't rely on your personal heroics. You actively protected your team's well-being by guarding the gates against initiative overload. You established relentless consistency, implemented trauma-informed behavioral policies, and earned the deep trust of both the staff and the students.
And just to be clear, the author of the source material executed this exact blueprint.
Yeah.
In their role as assistant head teacher, they implemented a highly successful organization-wide vision for teaching and learning.
They created a consistent pedagogical approach across all classrooms.
They significantly improved staff confidence. They linked complex SEN requirements directly to daily classroom practice through intensive, ongoing professional development.
What the education sector refers to as CPD, right?
Exactly. By all metrics, it was a massive, sustainable success. They poured a flawless, concrete foundation.
And despite that undeniable impact, despite doing absolutely everything right, the author was made redundant. They lost their job.
Yeah. Due to broader organizational restructuring, the position was just eliminated.
It feels like an immense cognitive dissonance.
It's a total gut punch.
It reminds me of serving as the architect for a beautiful, incredibly sturdy house. You draw the perfect blueprints, you lay a solid foundation, you build walls designed to withstand a hurricane.
Right.
And right as the final nail is hammered in, the bank forecloses on your contract, hands you your walking papers, and tells you to leave the property.
Wow.
You are locked out. But, and this is the crazy part, you have to walk away knowing that the people living inside that house are safe and secure solely because of the foundation you poured.
That analogy perfectly captures the profound emotional resilience required at the highest levels of leadership.
It's so unfair, though.
It is. The toughest realization outlined in the source material isn't about mastering a specific management technique or navigating a difficult conversation.
What is it, then?
It is the jarring acceptance that you can give absolutely everything to a role, execute your duties flawlessly, and still be deemed expendable.
Because strategic decisions at the executive or board level, like organizational restructurings, mergers, or redundancies, are almost entirely financial or political.
Yes, they are rarely performance-based. And that reality completely shatters the myth of the meritocracy.
Your hard work, your merit, and your success just do not equate to permanence.
And surviving that realization without becoming deeply cynical requires absolute confidence in your own values and immense professional integrity.
Which the author clearly has.
Oh, absolutely. The author notes something deeply poignant here. They say you will eventually outgrow certain environments, or those environments will shift in ways that no longer align with your presence.
Losing a role under those circumstances does not mean you failed.
Not at all. Very often it means you led incredibly well, but the structural needs of the organization simply changed.
The ultimate impact you have on an organization isn't always rewarded with long-term job security, but it is always meaningful.
Because leadership, in its truest form, is entirely about legacy.
What you leave behind. The skills you developed in your team, the psychological safety you establish, the robust systems that continue to function in your absence. That matters infinitely more than how many years your name is printed on the office door.
Synthesizing everything from the source material, true leadership completely detaches itself from the ego of a job title.
Yeah.
It isn't defined by tenure. It is measured by influence, the clarity of your vision, and the lasting strength of the people you build up along the way.
Well, you have covered a tremendous amount of ground today.
We really have.
You started in the lonely system building early days of management, realizing you have to put down the ball and become the coach.
Right.
You explored the heavy emotional labor of change management, discovering that protecting staff from burnout is a literal operational requirement for delivering quality care.
Yeah, not just a nice bonus.
Exactly. You saw how authentic trust is forged through relentless consistency and a data-informed, compassionate approach to human behavior.
And finally, we arrived at the bittersweet reality that a leader's worth is measured by their lasting impact, completely separate from their own job security.
Which leaves us with a highly provocative question to consider.
I'm ready.
If the absolute pinnacle of leadership is entirely about legacy, if the goal is to build robust, self-sustaining systems that do not rely on individual heroics or your personal charisma, is the ultimate objective of a truly great leader to make themselves completely obsolete?
Wow, think about that.
If you do your job flawlessly, the organization eventually runs perfectly without you. The house stands entirely on its own.
It does.
But what happens to the human ego when you succeed so thoroughly that you engineer your own irrelevance? Are you emotionally prepared for the obsolescence that comes with being a truly masterful leader?
That is a tough question to answer.
It is. Take these lessons, look closely at the systems you are building in your own career and your own relationships, and ask yourself, what kind of legacy are you actually leaving behind?